ജനശലാഖേ ചാക്ഷുരുന്മിളിതം ജിനതശ്മി ശ്രീഗുരവേ നമഃ നാമശ്രേഷ്ഠം മനുമാപി സച്ചിപുത്രം അത്രാശ്വരൂപം രൂപം തസ്യാഗ്രജമുരുപുരിം മാതരിം ഗുഷ്ടാവതിം രാധാകുന്ദം ഗിരിവരം മഹോരാധികമദാവസം പ്രാപ്തയസ്യ പ്രതിത്തഗ്രീപായ ശ്രീഗുരും തം നതസ്മി വഞ്ചകൽപ്പതരുഭ്യശ്ച കൃപാ സിന്ധുഭ്യൈവ ച പതിതാനം ഭവാനിഭ്യോ വൈഷ്ണവേഭ്യോ നമോ നമഃ നിഖിലാശ്രുതിമൗലിരത്നമാലതി നിരാജിതപദപങ്കജന്ത ആജിമുക്തകുലൈരുപശ്യാമനം പരിതസ്ത്വം ഹരിണം സംശയാമേ അനാരപിതചരീം ചിരാത്കരുണയാവതീർണാകലഹം ക്ഷമാർപ്പയിത്തമുന്നതോജ്വലരാസം സ്വക്തിശ്രിയം ഹരിപുരതസുന്ദരദ്യൂതികദംബ സന്ദീപിതാം സദാ ഹൃദയേ കന്ദരേ സ്ഫുരതു വാസചിനന്ദനഃ ജാനുലംബിതഭുജോഗണകാവദത് സങ്കീർത്തനൈകപിതരുകമലായതക്ഷ വിശ്വംബരോ ദ്വിയാവരോ ജുഗധാർമ്മപാലം വന്ദേ ജഗത്പ്രിയഗുരോ കരുണാവതാരോ ലതിനിശക്തിസ്വരൂപായ ഗൗരംഗചൂഹൃദായ ച ഭക്തശക്തിവ്രതനായ ഗദാധരനമസ്തുതേ ഹേ കൃഷ്ണകരുണാസിന്ധുദിനബന്ധോ ജഗത്പതേ ഗോപേശഗുപീകകാന്തരാധാകാന്തനമോസ്തുതേ രാധേവൃന്ദവനാദിശേഖരണമൃതവാഹിനി കൃപയാ നിജപാദബ്ജാദസ്യന്മയം പ്രദീയതം ഭക്തവിഹീനായപരാധലക്ഷൈ ക്ഷിപ്തശ്ചാകമാദിത്യരംഗമാദ്യേ കൃപമൈത്വം ശരണം പ്രപാനം വൃന്ദേന്മസ്തേ ചരണാർവിന്ദം വൃന്ദേന്മസ്തേ ചരണാർവിന്ദം ശ്രീ സച്ചിനന്ദൻ ഗൗർഹരി കീ ജയ്, ശ്രീഹരിനാം പ്രഭു കീ ജയ്, സമവേത ഭക്തവൃന്ദ കീ ജയ്, ഗൗർപ്രമാൻ ഹരി ഹരി ബോ. So, pranam to all of you. Very happy to meet you again after almost 2 weeks. Last week we couldn't make our weekly gathering because of travels back to the US. I'm here at Ananda Ashram, as you can see from the background. For a week or so after a very exciting, dynamic, intense, deep, broad, beautiful visit to Europe, where I had the blessing and fortune of crossing paths to many of you for the first time, second time, third time, 108th time, whether it was in Netherlands or in Italy or in Switzerland or in the UK or in Wales, which is part of the UK. So speaking about Wales, greetings to the Welsh family over there. Happy birthday to Sweta Dwip Radhika. She's having birthday today. Happy birthday to Aditi as well today. I don't know if she's connected, but anyhow, happy birthday to you as well. And yeah, it was beautiful. We had lots of fun together, lots of moments of gravity and depth and touching moments, and all hopefully all the rasas were on the menu in our various retreats and adventure in the Alps, in the mountains, on the land, in the beach, in whatever we happen to be meeting each other during the last few months. So now I'm here back in Ananda Ashram and looking forward to, in a few days, less than a week, starting my travels to Harvard. As you know, new adventure waiting over there, which, to be honest, I'm very much, as I say, I'm not developing many expectations, not because I'm like fatalistic and thinking nothing will happen, but just because I know whatever expectation I may have will be completely outweighed by the actual experience. And since I've never had such an experience, whatever expectations will come from a place of lack of that experience. So I prefer to remain as open as possible to the adventure, trying to hopefully trusting that it will be very nourishing for me and for everyone in connection to me, for all of us, for all of you. And in that connection, as it was announced in our WhatsApp group, I wanted just to share a few words, nothing too dramatic, just in case, but I wanted to share a few words in connection to this new chapter that is coming in a few days. Going to Harvard. Again, I'm very grateful for the opportunity. At the same time, I know it may change a little bit my rhythm of life, my dynamics, though I don't know because I'm not there yet. I haven't ever been there yet. So I'm open to that. At the same time, of course, I'm willing, and that's something non-negotiable for me to have our weekend satsangs as we're doing now. So I will leave Harvard if that's the price to pay. You hear me? But at the same time, I assume my daily dynamics will be quite focused in being there, assisting to classes, maybe sharing also part of the message there, and doing research and writing and studying, probably lots of reading. So in that sense, probably my availability will be on some degree affected. Hopefully not for bad. So in that sense, I expect not to be as available as I usually am, as I like to be. As I w normally am during the weeks. And since I assume the academic commitments will be demanding to some degree, though I want to make the whole experience sustainable for me as well. No interest in being overburdened and and burnt out, of course. But there will be some focus, natural focus, and some natural discipline while being there. But as I say, at the same time, I do not want to neglect our weekly gatherings, our weekend gatherings. I don't want to neglect being in touch with all of you, of course, as I also try to do on a personal basis whenever that's necessary. But at the same time, again, I may not be as available as I usually am for some more day-to-day messages or casual sharings, but of course, always available for any emergency bad signals that you may need to share. But at the same time, again, I'm sharing this because I don't feel this is a limitation. I've not seen that in any way as something negative. Actually, the main point I want to share is that I feel this change in dynamics for mostly the coming year as an opportunity for growth for us as members of the Sangha, right? Because as you already know, and as hopefully I will never be tired of saying, I never wanted that, I do not want to have Tathagata Sangha, our alliance, our community, to become something centered around me, over-centered around one person, and where everyone's spiritual connection or communication or whatever has to pass through one single individual. And that will be too much of a burden for me. That will create codependent dynamics, and I've seen enough of that in other sanghas too. Hopefully learn my lesson to some degree. And as we have talked many times, I think for me, a genuine sangha, a genuine community, family should be like a living web of relationships. It should be deeply relational, deeply mutual, deeply reciprocal. And so of course, my personal relationship with each one of you matters deeply, a lot. And again, it's non-negotiable for me. I'm not planning to compromise any of that. But also, I'm saying all that in the context of your relationship with each other should matter equally, hopefully. Because again, that's spiritual community, right? Spiritual community becomes much stronger when we begin to recognize that our brothers and sisters are also sources of inspiration, shelter, wisdom, encouragement, honesty, affection, so many things, right? So that's the main intention of this few introductory words today. So perhaps my being somewhat less available during the coming year, to some degree, again, I'm not disappearing absolutely. I'm not going anywhere in one sense. But somehow my becoming somewhat less available to some degree may hopefully invite all of us into a deeper stage of community life, no? Because there are always stages, and progress is the law of nature, as Bhaktivinoda Thakur will say. Everything is naturally progressing and growing and evolving. In relationship, things cannot remain static in one single place. So I see all this as a deeper invitation for a deeper stage of community life where we can call one another more, connect with one another more, get to know one another more, check in on one another more, which I think is very loving and important, studying together, sharing together, which of course it's already happening. I'm not saying now it starts to happen. That would be way more challenging. That's already happening, I would say, since day one, when we officially named Tathagata Sangha. I mean, I tried to make all this very clear, and we have tried to work on that, and it's happening beautifully through groups and sisterhoods and brotherhoods and group studies and our gatherings and individual friendships and connections. So in one sense, I'm not concerned because that's already happening, and I trust that the momentum of that already happening will just keep carrying itself in a deeper way, because the idea is that things keep getting deeper. It's getting better all the time, as the song says. So to invite us to another level of, yeah, communication, empathy, brotherhood, sisterhood, friendship, sharing together, revealing our hearts together, struggles together, sharing realizations together, learning from one another, discovering teachers, elders, juniors, peers, all as gurus in different ways. And yeah, learning to carry one another rather than falling into, which I'm not saying is happening, but hopefully it doesn't happen, falling to looking toward always the same person, which can always happen. So that's for me more a, this is all more of a preventive sharing rather than something that is taking place. So yeah, for me, basically those are the words I want to share today as part of spiritual maturity, basically, right? Like where any relationship with anyone, even your relationship with me, shouldn't develop at the cost of your relationship with everyone else or anyone else. But actually, however we are relating to one another should increase our connection with the center, should increase our connection with each other. It will increase the mutuality, the reciprocity. So we become more available and more capable of offering spiritual friendship to one another. I think that's a great invitation to develop our capacity to be friends and to befriend each other more deeply. Again, there is no end to the depth of friendship. There is no end to the depth of being a brother and sister. So that's my hope. I hope that you all, including me, don't leave me out of the equation, but I hope that you all discover even more deeply during this coming year, basically, a little bit less than a year, how much is already present within this Sangha. Again, I'm not talking about let's start doing something that is not already there, but let's keep discovering more in depth the gift we already have. There are, again, beautiful people like all of you, beautiful qualities, experiences, resources, perspectives, gifts, realizations, and that, again, sometimes perhaps some of those things we do not see them so fully because we may become accustomed to them, or we may become accustomed to a particular structure. So now, okay, there's a slight change of structure to some degree, again, nothing dramatic. So hopefully that slight change of structure with me being not as available may allow hidden forms of leadership or friendship and leadership in a healthy way. No, we are not bringing here any over-institutional hierarchical top-down stuff, but leadership in terms of taking responsibility for my own life and trying to help others to do the same, care, friendship. Hopefully all those hidden forms that are still waiting to be actualized may emerge more deeply. And again, if I need to clarify it one more time, that I'm going to Harvard, that I may be a little bit less available to the usual degree, doesn't mean that I'm disappearing entirely, that I'm becoming less connected with you, that I'm like abandoning you all. Please don't allow your mind to go to any ultra tragic, worst case scenario, apocalyptic scene place. I remain deeply committed to this community, deeply invested with each one of you as an individual, because that's what community is at the end of the day. It's not just an abstract bunch of people with these radically personal individuals behind the community. So I remain there, committed, trying to accompany you on your journeys, as I trust you are willing to accompany me in mine. It just simply means that, again, during this particular year, the form of my presence may have to change in some degree. But again, it doesn't mean it's less present. So it may shift to some degree. Again, and to some degree that I have no clue, because it's not that I can plan in advance how my experience in Harvard, my demands and availability will look like. I have zero clue. But I have some idea, at least to the degree that I've been doing some research. Okay, I will have my time to be available on the weekends for our sharing. And of course, again, I will want to be present for whatever is required for me to be present too. But again, I also hope that what I receive this year in Harvard, as I told to many of you during my travels, because that happened to be kind of the main question during my European tour. So Marash, you're going to Harvard. Tell me more about that. And I was a little bit, my answers were a little bit frustrating always, because I don't have many much of an idea what will be that about. And that was kind of the end of my conversation. But whatever may happen there, I of course, that's something I mentioned, which is whatever I received throughout the year there, through study, through dialogue, through new connections, encounters with other traditions, sister traditions, and whatever else may come with it, it's my hope and it's my commitment all that eventually flows back into our community, not even waiting for the time I'm leaving Harvard, throughout the time I'm there. That's what also makes sense for me to go there. If it will be just a personal, private project that starts, continues, and converges only in me, that will be so boring, so frustrating. So I'm not experiencing this as a separate things from the service to all of you. So all of you, I'm taking all of you to Harvard in another way. No, not maybe I don't have money to pay the tickets to each one of you. I don't have size in my luggage to put you in contraband inside there, but in the deepest possible way, I hope I'm taking all of you there. In another dimension of connection and the journey. So basically that I want to share. I would like us to enter this next chapter, not with a feeling of, oh, Marash will be less available, on a negative note, but perhaps with, I don't know, like a more creative question. Not with a negative statement that is conclusive. Marash won't be more as available, but with an open question, probably like, how can each of us become more available to one another? That gives us some homework for the upcoming year. And we all need to ask that question on a daily basis, whether I'm in Harvard or not. And I have to ask that question myself, how we can become more available to one another. There comes the prompt. You already know me with my prompts. So again, if we ask that question sincerely and deeply, I trust that then this transition, whatever that may be, will make our Sangha more and more center around relationship, around a feeling of family, shared community, service, the sweet absolute as the root of all existence, and again, the shared journey that we are trying to cultivate together will basically foster and reassure whatever is already taking place. And again, for me to witness that will be something very beautiful, very inspiring, that already is happening again. So I'm just bearing witness to what's already taking place. We're seeing this community, seeing each one of you blooming as the unique individuals you are, becoming increasingly capable of standing together in the beauty and the messiness of diversity, being humans. And again, standing together not because one person is holding everything together and collapsing in the attempt of doing that, but because there are many genuine bonds of affection, of trust, of responsibility, of friendship that are holding us together. Already that's taking place. So let that continue to flourish onto its next desired level. So basically that, I'm very happy and I'm entering this new chapter with gratitude, with excitement, with openness to the unpredictable and the unexpected, trusting it will be for the better of everyone. And again, with a great deal of trust in each of you. So I hope this year also becomes not only a new chapter for me, but in some way a new chapter for you and for all of us as a Sangha. So basically that, I don't want to my introduction to take over our gathering, but since I'm going to Harvard in a few days and actually our next satsang next Saturday, I already will be there. I felt inspired to share these thoughts, which I hope land properly in each other's heart. And thank you for sending your digital hearts over there. So that said, we move forward now to our Q&A, to our questions and answers. But why not go to breakout room first for all of you to churn together about what you just heard? I think that will be an interesting thing to do before we officially start with whatever inquiries, quests, explorations you have today. We can open the breakout rooms for a few minutes and allow each other to express whatever needs to ex be expressed to each other, to put to embody in motion what I just say in theory, basically, and continue to foster our connection. So Dr. Raza will activate the groups now, and then I'm seeing four raised hands already, so I'll be seeing you in a few moments back. Thank you. Welcome you back. Sorry if it was not enough time for you to share. Feel free again, as part of what we just shared a few minutes ago. Feel free to take the initiative of continuing to communicate with one another and share your hearts mutually. But thank you. Thank you for your presence and for your blessings in this new chapter. And that's it. We continue with our usual weekend dynamics in our satsang, where each of you are invited if you have any question, quest, exploration, topic you may like to bring to the table. And there were already four digital hands initially raised, so I will be following that particular order. So far, we have four. The first one was coming from Jamuna. So we invited Jamuna, then Kanupriya, then Bhakta Prem, and then Nityananda eventually.
Okay. Initially, Bhakta Prem was the brave one to put his hand up, but he doesn't want to go. Okay. So this is about a statement being taken literally as I'm slowly letting go of my literal reading of things, but I've also heard others finding it hard to see anything other than literal. So it's about the statement that you often speak of from Śrīla Śrīdhara Mahārāja, which is saying the guru is your potential standing before you. And this got sparked by something strange the other day where somebody said to me, "Oh, you," it was in regards to social media. They went, "You could be the next Swami Padmanabha." And I was like, I said, I have enough trouble trying to be myself rather than being anyone else. Sorry, someone's just come in. So one thing that it sparked in me is how we take things literally. And I have seen how people think that being spiritual or following in the footsteps of the guru is maybe speaking like the guru does. If the guru has got maybe a slightly broken Indian English accent, to speak like that, to use the guru's mannerisms, to get the same shade saffron cloth as the guru, to wear the same aftershave that the guru does. And it's all about the externals of, So I know that that is not what that statement is about, but for the literalist hearing that, it might get a little wonky on it. So
So,
over to you.
okay. Okay, thank you. Thank you for sharing. And of course, I'm glad to say nobody's dressing like me. No one is following my hairstyle. I don't have a hairstyle to begin with, so we are good. Nobody's moving the hands like I do when I'm talking, so we are good. But going to Śrīla Śrīdhara Mahārāja's line, for me it's clear, even if you take it literally, and sometimes we do need to take things literally. It's not that it's altogether bad to read things literally. Sometimes you need to take things literally so you do not interpret the things for something that is not, and you are creating your own story that is not healthy. And this is an example. Because Srila Samar is saying the guru is your own potential appearing in front of you. So the guru is, he's not saying the guru is his own potential, her own potential appearing as you, or stuff like that. He's saying, in other words, the idea is the guru is embodying all that you can be. But that, of course, I know that is still, as much as I try to clarify, we can read a form, we can embrace a form of literalism that is ends up being imitation, and doesn't, it's not the intention of this particular quote. As I mentioned, I think I wrote that in the chapter on Guru Tattva and Radical Personalism. We can define the guru in so many ways, and one way could be the guru is a facilitator of the process of individuation. Right? The guru is someone or someone's, again, not to, to keep the idea of guru plural and never reduce it to one single person only. But the guru or the guru principle is a department of people that will be there supporting your individuation, your becoming who you actually are and all that you can be. No? That's a genuine guide. The genuine guide is not expecting for replicas. No, it's not expecting for copy-paste automatons. No? That would be boring. Imagine if I mean, poor guru to begin with. Imagine a guru surrounded by people who speak like him or her, move their hands, mannerism, dress. It's like enter into a hall of mirrors, basically. I mean, unless you are the most narcissistic person on earth, that won't sit well with you. And we would like to assume that a guru is not the most narcissistic person on earth, though it can happen if we don't get what it means to be a guru properly. So no, it's not about imitation, but a caveat comes there, which is many times relationships between teacher and student begin with some form of imitation. Many relationships begin with some form of imitation. And there is a healthy place for that. Again, like when going to the classic example, the baby is imitating his parents, no? To many degrees that even the parents are not aware of and the baby is not aware of. But it's a gradual, how to say, in the beginning it's just emerging. In the beginning, the baby even doesn't know he has his own identity. Baby is mom, and I are one. Without saying that, of course. But the sense of identity is of the type of Sayujja, no, type of Vatsalya Sayujja, merging in the mother. No? Then the Sayujja becomes a little bit more nuanced. Babies merge with mother and father, and eventually the baby realizes, oh, there is someone called me. But still is utterly dependent of mom and dad, and it's totally necessary. I mean, if you cancel that, I mean, how long can the baby survive? How functional can his growth be? And all that includes some form of imitation, no? Like replicating the movements, what they say, how they think, what they do, over-idealizing them. They are superhero, they are perfect, they are infallible, and therefore you imitate that. And it's a whole bunch of things that eventually all of them need to be thrown out of the window. But during some time, they need to be kept at home, so to say, as a necessary foundation for, which from an adult's perspective could be seen as, oh, but that's very primitive, that's very archaic, that's very imitational. Yeah, all of that, but still, that's totally necessary. So I'm saying all that to basically normalize that for some people, that's unavoidable, that's actually necessary, so we shouldn't condemn those who need to inhabit those shoes. As we were talking in the UK retreat, Yamuna, and you wrote a poem about shoes in the UK, because we gave this example, right? Like, we need to enter into a certain pair of shoes, and we shouldn't enter into a pair of shoes that is bigger to our foot, because we won't be able to walk properly. But if we try to put shoes that are way smaller than our foot, we won't be able to walk properly either. in different ways, it will be messy. So my point with this is, for some time we may need to imitate, for some time we need to be in kindergarten bhakti, spirituality. For some time that will be the necessary case. The problem is when we are ready to move forward and we insist on when we refuse individuation, when we refuse embracing our individuality. That's the problem. And that's why ideally we are talking here about guru. A guru should have the capacity or the maturity and the vision to see all that happening. Now, on one side, the guru should see, okay, this student is coming from an utterly codependent place, and it's imitating me from tip to toe, but that's the only thing possible so far. And so we have to hold space for that. And we have to take care that nobody's bullying that person for imitating, because for that person, that's not imitation. That's their most genuine way they know to be. So the guru should create a safe space for that neophyte, if you want to use that word without stigmatizing that, to be protected. You know? Like, again, it's like if you see a baby imitating their parents, it's cute and charming. You know, you won't bully the baby into, why are you imitating mom and dad? You should individuate. No. So there should be even an appreciation and a charm and a holding of space for those who need to be there. And the guru should have the capacity to see when that's the case, when should see when someone comes from that place, should know how to hold space for that to happen, but also should know how to lovingly poke the student when it's time to graduate, right? It's time to change to a bigger pair of shoes. Because if not, it starts to become codependently toxic, and that's loss for both the student and the teacher. And unfortunately, sometimes that's not the case. Sometimes maybe gurus do not see that, could see that, but they are not taking the time or trouble to see all those things and work in connection to their students, and then some problems happen. Or sometimes they are not equipped, unfortunately, in some cases, with this foundational psychology, so to say, psychological sensibility in terms of relationships. So they may allow, they may be infantilizing their disciples, or they may infantilize themselves by how they are being approached by their students. And the whole weather, whole climate of immaturity may be created, fanaticism. So many different varieties of fermentation may come from that. So that's why it's very important. And that's a big important role of the student, and many times of the guru, sorry, to see all that, and especially again, try to lovingly invite the student when it's time to grow to a bigger version of both the student and the teacher. And many times that's not easy for the student to see. And the guru also has to remain firm in that stance, lovingly firm, but not like compromise his or her stance just for the sake of the disciples' comfort, so to say. Because if not, stagnation starts to become the norm. So it becomes a whole disempower a system of disempowerment in all directions, rather than a system of empowerment. Guru Parampara ideally is a system of empowerment for everyone. It's not unidirectional. It's not just guru blessing and empowering the rest, but the teacher also needs inspiration and empowerment. We all need that. You can never get enough nourishment. So it should be moving in all directions. It's reciprocal. Again, if it's not reciprocal, it's not relationship. Now, if it's not reciprocal, it's not relational. So everyone should be, as much as as much as anyone can see, anyone should be very concerned about helping each other to actualize their maximum potential. Ideally, this is most typically seen from the guru toward the disciple, but as the disciple grows, there is naturally this loving concern of wanting everyone to flourish in their biggest potential. Everyone, guru included, why not? That's a gesture of love and well-wishing. That doesn't mean I'm higher than anyone, I'm better than you, or that is just a genuine well wishing. But again, committing ourselves to that view, I want everyone's potential to bloom without stop. That invites for discomfort, that invites for change, that invites for movement, that invites for growth. And that's the price we have to pay. We have to be willing to grow and change. And days that may not feel comfy, as they will say here. But again, that's the price to pay. If we are not willing to pay any price for change of transformation, then that means we are deceiving ourselves. We are just looking reassurance and confirmation from everyone just to remain where we are. And that's not what healthy life, what to speak of spirituality, is about. So that will be basically the idea of guru is your highest potential appearing in front of you. A portal of aspiration, as we talk also in the UK, a portal of longing. And I can see the trouble with that quote, as beautiful as it is, in so many ways we can be affected negatively, because as I mentioned also, I remember in radical personalism, if my brightest potential appears in front of me personified, that can feel overwhelming, because it can be a constant reminder that I'm not there yet. And I may never be there yet, because my potential keeps upgrading and actualizing itself. So how to deal with that darshan, with that vision of my embodied potential reflected in front of me without going crazy? And as we remember, we talked also in the UK, the distance between where I am and where I want to be need not become shame. It can become longing. So whatever space I feel I'm still falling short of doesn't need to become a chance, an opportunity for shaming myself, feeling bad about myself, but it can become fuel for longing. It can nourish my aspiration. There's no end to that nourishment. So in these ways, we can relate to the notion of guru being an embodiment of potential in ways that are healthy. And again, potential is unique. We are in unique individuals. So at the end of the day, once we pass the kindergarten stage of imitation, anukar means this in Sanskrit, anukar. There is this play of words between these two terms in Sanskrit, anukar and anusar. So sar means essence. So anusar means to follow in the footsteps of the essence. Anukar means to do what the other person is doing. So in the beginning, we do what the other person is doing. Eventually, we capture the essence coming from that person, and we follow that in our own unique, unrepeatable, individuated way. And it doesn't happen from one day to another, of course. There is a spectrum in that transition. But that's how it should happen, moving from anukar to anusar. And sometimes when you're in anusar and you're capturing the essence of what someone is doing, in their own way, you will take that essence and you will replicate it in your own way, and externally may look completely different. But you are actually being completely loyal to the essence. No? Like, for example, just one example that comes to my mind. When Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur became initiated by Gaurakishore Das Babaji, one of the first instructions, if not the first, he received from his Gurudev was, Gaurakishore Das Babaji said, never go to Kolkata. The first thing that Prabhupada Bhaktisiddhanta basically does is to go to Kolkata. So that may sound like, not even imitation, that may sound like heresy, right? Like you are doing the exact opposite of what you were told to do. And when someone curiously asking, like, why you moved to Kolkata, your Gurudev said not to go to Kolkata. And he said, I've never gone to Kolkata. I always remain at the lotus feet of my Gurudev. That's not Kolkata. So again, he understood the instruction of his Gurudev in an essential way, and it took a form that not only looked different, but even opposite. Right? But he was doing anusar. He was following the essence. He was not imitating or even showing some false humility or submission. Just see, yeah, tell me what to do and I do it. Again, there is a place for that. There is a place where we need to be told what to do and do it. And there is a place where we connect more deeply with the intention behind the instruction. The not the bapu of the bani, but the bani of the bani, not the form of the instruction, but the essence of the instruction. And then we will be able to follow that instruction accordingly. And that may take different forms. And those who are not trained in that, they may think, oh, you're a heretic, you're a deviant, you are disobeying your guru because you are not following, how they say, the letter of the law. No, that person now is following the spirit of the law. And that will change according to time, place, and circumstance. And of course, that's part of the unavoidable conflict that may be in between those who see things more formally or literally or externally and those who are more trying to live their lives in a more substantial way. Not necessarily one will fully understand the other. Unavoidable. Part of the mess, beautiful messiness of life. So anyhow, some reflections. I don't know if anything lands for Yamuna over there.
Yeah, that was fantastic. And it took lovely, unexpected turns. Thank you very much.
Lovely. Thank you. Okay, let's move one more time to our breakout rooms. Why not? I think it's an important topic worthy of churning and ruminating together. The other day, Bhaktarasa was telling me how, I don't remember the term, of the cows where they are eating for a second or third time. How you call that?
Chewing cud.
Chewing cud. So because cows have like four stomachs, so... Huh? So churning, and that's why we're sending you over and over again to breakout rooms. So you are moving from one stomach to the other and continue to ruminate, chewing what has been chewed. Punas, punas, charvita, charvananam, like the Bhagavatam said. Now, Prahlad will say that in a negative way. People in this world chew what everyone else has chewed. But there's a positive connotation of that, which is what we are trying to do in the breakout rooms, continuing to chew and to ruminate from one stomach, from one heart to the other. So invited to go there and see you back in a few minutes. Welcome back. Hope you had some good rumination from one stomach to the other, from one heart to the other. Before moving to the next exploration, I don't know if there's anything publicly shareable that you feel it must that came during your private conversation or private personal contemplation. You can unmute yourself directly without raising your digital hand, so we don't confuse the hands raised for the questions. Anything?
Shri Radhe, Radhe, Radhe. We just wanted to share our progressions of baby Dandavat pranams, aka Tommy time. And there's something about the yes of doing on her, but the natural, you know, spirit even as she's doing it. So, on Anusar.
Lila Jay pranam. See you for Govardhan Dandavat Parikram. I give you 15 years. 15 years I give you.
7 years.
Seven years. Okay. That gives me more hope to myself as well. Jai Sri Radhe. Something else? Someone also training over there for Dandavat Parikram? That's an adventure, I can tell you. Okay.
Just one very, yes, very, very quick thing on the,
Yamuna,
slightly off the topic, but of the chewing of the cud. I was thinking chewing of the cud, when the cows do that, they're creating milk, and from chewing the cud, the milk comes and the cream comes, and so many beautiful preparations, milk preparations come from that.
Yeah.
So just
sharing. Yeah, 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 totally. Because sometimes we say, yeah, it comes from cows, from grass, it transforms into milk, but there is a whole in-between sequences of chewing and rumination that makes for this sara. No, sara means also cream or essence, which somehow we relate to milk or milk products. So yeah, if you want something substantial and nutritious, you may need to spend some time chewing as well, contemplating, yeah. And something brief before going to the next question, which is something that Trivikram shared in the chat, which says, can one legitimately abandon a guru who employs a policy of capping the potential of a disciple? Of course, I'm replying in general. I'm not addressing any specific case. In principle, the answer is yes, because basically a guru is a facilitator of potential. So if a guru, quote unquote, is basically obstructing your potential by definition, that's not a guru. So guru is a function that dispels ignorance. Guru in itself is not a person. Guru is the function of dispelling ignorance, which in a positive way could be framed as the function of activating potential, facilitating potential. So if that's not taking place, then the guru function is not operating through that individual or group or whatever. Of course, so I'm saying that in general. At the same time, in any given particular situation, there are endless details to consider that I do not know, and I cannot bring them into the table here, because many times it's not just a black and white thing. Oh, this happened. Sometimes the disciple may interpret an action from the gurus obstructing potential, but it may not be the case. And sometimes the disciple may need clarification to see that there's an actual canceling or disrupting of the potential, or actually is a facilitation of potential that I never dared to imagine it could take that form. That can happen. So as a student, one shouldn't be entirely sure about one's own thoughts and perceptions after clarifying and having conversations and back and forth with that person, with other people. And even if it happens to be the case that in whatever circumstance the guru may not be functioning as such, as a facilitator of potential, but the other way around, there's always space to talk with the gurus. Narhari Sarkar will recommend in Krishna Bhajanamrita and have honest, genuine conversations about what's taking place and seeing where that takes, which resolution takes place, hopefully in one way or another. So I'm saying all this to give a glimpse of how nuanced the whole thing can be, and then just touch upon a few of the possibilities. So we don't take it again literally and just, oh yeah, Maharaj say yes, boom, I'm rejecting this, and you have to reject. I'm not saying that. I just gave the reply in principle, but then when you move something from what's in principle to the specifics of each case and scenario, there is a whole world of considerations there, and we should take them in place so we are not impulsively reacting or overreacting or whatever. So thank you for that. And we are moving to the next raised digital hand coming from Kanupriya. But both are here, so I'm not sure which of the two, the one who will activate the microphone, which is from Switzerland, Scotland. Kanupriya, welcome.
Welcome and thank you. Yeah, I did listen to the Gadadhar Saptaha you gave in Switzerland, and I was very, very touched. So my question is towards that, and I would love to understand Mahaprabhu in Gambira a bit better, but I would like to look from the Nitya perspective. So if we know there is a Nitya Navadvip, so there must be a Nitya Gambira. And I was wondering, in this Nitya Gambira, so that would be the first part of my question, when Mahaprabhu really feels this super intense Radha Viraha, so which is the epitome of the feelings of separation there. In that moment, is he missing Gadadhar also? So does he have a part, so the Krishna part, which is also still, can he feel such feelings in that moment, or is it 100% he's allowed at that moment to feel how Radha feels? Or is he having almost like two Virahas, like I miss also Gadadhar, who is not allowed to be there in that moment? So that's the first part. And the second, if we know that this is eternal, as also Radha Krishna, the Leela, the Rasa dance Leela is eternal, going on, and we know they are existing not separate. So how is this Gambira, this intensity there, having an impact on Radha Krishna and their feelings in separation? Because it's not separate. So it has to have. If Mahaprabhu, the Gaurlila is an appendix, which is not really an appendix, but it has to be vice versa. And maybe you can say something also on that.
Okay. We move from the four stomachs of the cows to the Gambira. It's all related, nothing disconnected here. Thank you for the question, Kanupriya, or the questions. Though I may add to that that your, of course, most of your questions are based on the notion of Gambira, Nitya Gambira. And some Vaishnavas will argue to that, saying, well, that's an assumption. in the sense that it's, I mean, there are many opinions. Let's bring diversity to the table to begin the conversation. There are even, and we have talked about that in some of our conversations with Krishna Chandraji during the Gadadhar Saptaha in Ananda Dham. But there are some, not many, but a few Vaishnavas, a particular line in the Gaudiya Sampradaya, which does not even consider the Nityanavadvip possibility. They consider Gaurlila as something only happening on earth, so to say, but not as an eternal destination in transcendence. They will say that only Radha Krishna or Vrindavan Lila is the eternal possibility, and Gaurlila is more of a earthly lila that happens over here and serves as a bridge to Krishna Lila. And the main argument, and again, I don't want to get too much into that, but the main argument will be the Goswamis never spoke in detail about Nitya Navadvipa or Nitya, what to speak of Nitya Puri, Nitya Gambira, Nitya Gaurlila. So if the Goswamis haven't spoken about that, then we do not accept that. Okay, I get the point personally, but at the same time, there are many things that the Goswamis never didn't speak and we accept as Gaudiya Vaishnavas. And I can name a few. Just again, the Goswamis to begin with haven't spoken much about Mahaprabhu at all. So that means that, I mean, speaking by the Goswamis as the six Goswamis, they compose a few ashtakams, pranam mantras at the beginning of their works. Of course, I'm not denying any of that. And that's it. No. What we know about Mahaprabhu and his life was shared by other associates, not the six Goswamis. So doesn't mean that all the things that are written in Chaitanya Charitamrita, Chaitanya Bhagavat, the life of Mahaprabhu, I don't accept any of that because that was not revealed by the six Goswamis. That wouldn't make much sense. So in the same way, there are many revelations that can come in preceding, you say, in preceding generations after the Goswamis, which as long as they do not contradict their Siddhanta, they are welcome. And for example, and we mentioned that in Switzerland, why there is not like a detailed treatment of Mahaprabhu in the books of the Goswamis, or why there is not a detailed treatment of the position of Gadadhar in books like Chaitanya Charitamrita. Well, each one of them were trying to make a very deep, important theological point, each in their own way. So if they will try to encompass everything, it may have been too much. No. For some people, it's even difficult to believe there is God. For some people, it's more difficult to believe that God can be Krishna, who is God, without being aware that he's God, lost in the love of Vrindavan. And on top of that, more difficult is to accept that Mahaprabhu, his historical figure, was not only Krishna, but rather than Krishna, combined in a dynamic way. And on top of that, to add that, and apart from that, there is Gadadhar. No, it would have been probably too much for some of the readers, as we could conclude some of the authors concentrated on making certain points, establishing, I don't know, Jiva Goswami, the Goswami, establishing bhakti as a goal, not only as a temporary means to moksha, but as means and as end result, and so many other things. And whatever little things the Goswamis wrote about Mahaprabhu, interestingly enough, that should be enough for us to play out the implications of that and conclude there is a Nitya Navadvip. For example, they will speak in the few pranam mantras they compose and in the few astakams written by the Goswamis about Sri Chaitanya there. They, for example, refer to Mahaprabhu as avatar. So avatar means descent, literally. That's the etymology of avatar, coming down, descent. So you cannot come down if you are not coming down from somewhere. So if Mahaprabhu is an avatar, Mahaprabhu has an abode from which he is descending, which we call Nitya Golok Navadvip or Golok Puri. Now we'll go to Puri in a minute. Or the Goswamis will refer to Mahaprabhu as their Ishtadev. So an Ishtadev cannot be a temporary one. You can establish an Ishtadev that is disposable. An Ishtadev has to remain there for eternity. So if and they clearly establish Mahaprabhu as Ishtadev in their pranam mantras and mangala charan. So that's by implication shows Gaur Lila is an eternal reality. So things like that, examples like that's those will be my arguments to the point that there is no Gaur Lila in transcendence. And of course, there are some associates of Mahaprabhu, like Gopal Guru Goswami and then Dhyanachandra Goswami, who again were Gopal Guru Goswami in particular was a direct associate of Mahaprabhu, and he wrote in detail about Nityanavadvipa in his Padati, in his manual. And then his disciple, Dhyanachandra Goswami, and then the other compositions, one attributed to Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur, sometimes called Gauranga Lilamrita, and then more contemporary Vaishnavas like Bhaktivinoda Thakur, Srila Sridhar Maharaj, they openly, clearly spoke about Nityanavadvipa, and those who have an affinity to serve Mahaprabhu. There is that portal in eternity. Those who have affinity to serve Radha Krishna in Vrindavan, they can go there. It's not they are forced to go to Nityanavadvipa. And those who have both affinities, they can go to both places, which at the end of the day is not both two places, but one expressed in different ways. Now, going to the possibility of Jagannath Puri being eternal, that's another conversation. I would say that's not so much of a popular doctrine in the Gaudiya tradition, though it's not entirely absent. There are a few, remember talking with Madhavananda Prabhu, he lives in Puri. He's a researcher about many things Puri, many things locals to Puri. He told me that he found a few even Astakaliya Lila Smaran Stotrams about Gaur Lila in Puri. And one could interpret some sections of Brihadbhagavatamrita as well, where Sanatana Goswami is speaking about Gopakumar's visiting different planets in transcendence and at one point visiting Puri. So one could make a case, okay, there is a Nitya Puri. And most Gaudiyas, and again, I'm not saying this fanatically, there is variety in the menu, but most Gaudiyas probably will argue, yeah, but in that case, Puri will be a little bit more of an Aishwarya Leela of Mahaprabhu as a sannyasi, which will be more comparable to Mathura or Dwarka with Krishna rather than Vrindavan. And Navadvip retains more of the intimacy and familiarity of Vrindavan when Mahaprabhu is with his family and eternal associates. He's at home, so to say. He's not exiled as a sannyasi, so to say. So in that sense, the main emphasis in eternity tends to go to Navadvip, not to Puri. Not to cancel that possibility. Who am I to cancel anything of that? At the same time, of course, comes this point, and we spoke with that about that with Krishna Chandra, that, well, but also in the earthly Leela, we see that the Haige speaks of Mahaprabhu's experiencing of Radha-bhava happened in Puri, not in Navadvipa. So one could make a case for, okay, Puri is even superior, though we don't want to fall into this higher, lower hierarchy in terms of eternal abodes. At the same time, we could make the case of, well, you can say that, but remember, if we accept that Gaur Lila is eternal, it doesn't mean that Mahaprabhu's relishing of Radha-bhava began on earth in Navadvipa and continuing in Puri. It's already taking place in eternity in the spiritual world, and it takes a certain development on earth for us to witness that unfolding. But as we say, there is no beginning to that project because Gaur Lila is eternal. So it's not that, okay, it began this day, that time, and there's no end to that project. No. So no matter how high the peaks of Radha Bhav that Mahaprabhu relished in Gambira, that's not the end of the story. No. And I know it's difficult for us to think in those terms because we tend to think in linear terms. Now, the story began on 1486 when Mahaprabhu was born on earth and it finished in Puri Gambira, and we see the gradual zenith attain in Puri, end of the story. And in itself is a beautiful story if we just take the earthly part. Okay, beautiful story. But that story began before that and continues after it. So the point to make is, I mean, I wouldn't make much strong of a case that in Puri, the Heige thing happening, the Heige thing is happening always all over. It takes a certain unfolding here, but it continues to unfold and it was previously unfolding. So that will be part of my reply in connection to your question on the Gambira and the assumption of a Nitya Puri. I wouldn't say that we need a Gambira and a Nitya Puri in eternity for Mahaprabhu to relish what he needs to relish. I will say he can be Nitya Navadvip and again continue to explore in eternal depth right above. And it's not like, okay, I need to go somewhere else, I need to take sannyas. I mean, he ended up relishing all that in Puri because he ended up taking sannyas and part of his, I mean, there are many reasons, of course. On an external way, we say part of his sannyas vows was he cannot remain at home. He had to go somewhere else. And Sachimata said, okay, go to Puri, which is not, it's far enough, but close enough at the same time. At the same time, of course, Puri is called as Viparalamba Kshetra, the land of separation. So Mahaprabhu there, Krishna's Mahaprabhu relished right above, mostly in separation, trying to show the way to us, how the entrance to union is through separation. But again, he's relishing right above in Navadvip deeply and eternally as well, both union and separation. And regarding your question about Gadadhar, and if in those moments, if we were to assume, okay, there's a Nitya Puri and a Nitya Gambira, or even addressing the earthly experience of those abodes, in the depths of Mahaprabhu relishing Radhabab, is there a place in him in which he remembers Gadadhar or misses Gadadhar? The answer is, I don't know. That's a very personal question that you need to ask to Bhagavan himself. Yeah, I'm not Bhagavan, so I cannot fully speak for Bhagavan. We can speak about God to some degree, but it feels like too audacious to fully speak for what's going on in God's heart in every way at any single moment. So I leave that between you and Bhagavan. But of course, in one way, we have to humble ourselves and recall at the end of the day, as sweet and intimate and human-like these lilas are, or fully human, these lilas are, they're also fully divine, and we are still dealing with the infinite here. So our ways of thinking and trying to conceive and even ask some of the questions, which are totally perfect, and I'm not criticizing any of that, are all exceeded by the reality of the infinite. So yeah, we could say we're dealing with the infinite. So yeah, Mahaprabhu can be absolutely engrossed in Radhabhav, but still there can be a part of Krishna, because that's still Krishna. And we see that in Nitya Navadvip, no? Going back to Nitya Navadvip, where we will say Mahaprabhu is daily, eternally, deeper and deeper relishing Radhabhav, still in the depictions of the Ashtakaliya Lila or the Eightfold daily pastimes in Nitya Navadvip, Mahaprabhu at times relishes Krishna Bhav, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Not only Radha Bhav. No? Though we will say that's the prominent, and that's what makes Gaur Lila have a main purpose, because if you take that out, what's the need of Gaur Lila in one sense? So that's what makes Gaur Lila unique. But that doesn't exclude of Mahaprabhu relishing at times Krishna Bhav. And from that perspective, one could argue, okay, from that place he can experience the other things that he that may not be experienced in the foreground while being deeply imbued in Radhabhav. And which are the repercussions of all that for Radha and Krishna in Braja Lila? We need to go there and find it for ourselves. All right? There are indeed repercussions. Again, there, we are not talking about two entirely separate realms, because Navadvip and Vrindavan, as Krishna is not different from Mahaprabhu, and Radha is not different from Gadadhar, now it is not different from Vrindavan. So one place and one lila are the same. So whatever happens in one happens in the other, because the other is not another. So it's just, I don't know. I mean, I'm just giving a very limited example over here. But imagine you're having a certain impact in your connection with I mean, again, it's just completely different because we cannot make a parallel to that. But you have an impact in your relationship with someone, and then you relate to someone else, and still that impact affects every other relationships. Again, I'm not, it's a different example. The example is not entirely accurate. But yeah, at the end of the day, I think it's always healthy to leave the conversation with under a veil of mystery to some degree, and with leaves the door open for us to explore how our own experience, ask those very personal questions to Bhagavan and Bhagavati themselves, and go there and find whatever needs to be found by being there, by inhabiting the questions in one sense. But of course, it's worthy what we are doing here, but I think it's healthy that we can speak as much as we can. And when it's time to be sober and say, okay, let's stop here. The rest, Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur will say, the rest will be revealed in samadhi. The rest will be revealed in meditation. That's how the Bhagavatam worked, right? Vyasadeva was in certain complicated situation. He went to his guru Narad, how to solve my conundrum. And Narad Muni say a few words and they said, now enter into samadhi. That's a very interesting instruction. And Vyasadeva could do it. But the point is, the guru said some things and then he instructed the disciple, now enter into deep meditation, where all the things that cannot even be said, put into words, will be revealed in that inner space. And whatever still doesn't make sense, even by hearing my words as your guru, will become fully revealed and accommodated. So there is space for both, to ask the questions, to receive answers, to think about them, and then to enter deeply into a transrational space of prayer, of bhajan, and allowing whatever further revelation remains to become manifest. So I hope that helps.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I just thought maybe you, because you know Shastra so very well and I don't, so I thought maybe there is something or somewhere something written, and no, but I'm very fine with.
Yeah, you may need to enter samadhi and write that book yourself, Kanupriya. That's how it works, parampara.
Thank you very much.
You enter into the deep space and then write your testimony, what happened over there, as much as one can put that into words.
And the question would also work without going to the Nitya, even without Nitya.
Yeah.
Does he have these feelings? Does he have still the feelings from he as Krishna in Gambhira or not? That can be brought down to the Prakatila. So it does not need to be a Prakat.
Yeah.
Also, yeah, how is it having an impact? Even it ends here on earth, the consciousness is still God's consciousness. So it has to have an impact somehow.
Yeah.
Thank you so very much.
Thank you. Thanks so much. Okay. Seeing that we still have two more questions and still we have some time, I will skip and we skip some breakout rooms. So I'll just skip this one. We'll move to the next question. We have two more raised hands, originally following the original order from Bhakta Prem now, and next we'll go to Nityananda. So Bhakta Prem, you can unmute yourself and bring your offering. Welcome.
Thank you, Maharaj. Standards for all of you. I have two questions.
And only one.
I can say two and you decide.
Let's not be tricky. Let's bring one question per person.
Okay. Okay, so I will read the second one.
And you speak Spanish and you always join the Spanish Q&A tomorrow. So come on, okay. Bring the other one tomorrow.
Okay. Continue with Mahaprabhu. So I will ask you the second question.
Okay.
So about 20 years ago, I hear a class from one sannyasi. He's speaking about Mahaprabhu. He's having, I mean, the Thakurjis of Mahaprabhu, he having one hand up and one hand down. And he explains that with the hand up, he is tasting like the rasa and everything. And the hand down, he's giving us all what.
Yeah.
And the question is, the Dharmeshwar Mahaprabhu, the first Thakurji of was worshipped by Vishnu Priya Devi. He has both hands down. If you want to say something aloud, or I don't know, whatever comes to you, to explore that subject. And yeah, thank you very
Thank you.
much.
Yeah,
Sorry
thank
about
you.
that.
Thank you for the question. You may need to ask this question to Manjwali, right? See Manjwali's eyes brimming. That's a more personal thing because we went to there to visit Damesh Mahaprabhu last year. Now the Dhamparikraman that happened, that resulted one of the favorite places, not only of Manjwali, of course, of many of us, but her especially, for different reasons. So yeah, Dameshwar Mahaprabhu Ki Jai. Of course, these different mudras, positions of the hands can be explained in different ways. We shouldn't become too like entangled into, okay, only when the hands are like this is happening, and if the hands change, one thing stop being like, I don't know, someone maybe, again, if we read this literally, okay, when Mahaprabhu has both hands down, that means he's not giving the higher thing any longer. Now he's just giving something low, whatever. We can read, filter things with our own lenses, but that's not the point. Yeah, and one way of explaining one hand up, one hand down is as you did, or as this sannyasi did, as many do, like hand raised, he's relishing Radha Bhav, the higher thing. Hand down, he's giving, as Gaur Govinda Maharaj will say, explaining the name Mahavadanya, and that's a name for Mahaprabhu, the most magnanimous. Namo Mahavadanyaya, Krishna Prema Pradayate. No, so he's the most magnanimous because he's the most magnanimous, Gaur Govinda Maharaj will say, is the one who is experiencing the higher thing and giving it even to the lowest. Because someone can give something to the lowest, which is not the highest. Someone can give the highest only to the highest, or not to the lowest. There can be some measure of not full unconditional giving or experiencing. But if you are experiencing, relishing the deepest thing and extending that gift to everyone, then that person deserves the title Mahavadanya, no? The most merciful personality, and that's a name for Mahaprabhu. So those two hands represent that. But of course, again, we have pictures of Mahaprabhu with both hands up, which doesn't mean that at that moment he became less generous and now he's just selfishly relishing his own thing and not giving anything to anyone. Nor if he has both hands down means, oh, now he's not giving anything higher anymore. No, it's just different ways of explaining the same thing. He's relishing and extending, relishing and extending. For example, if you not only, and we go there to Dameshwar Mahaprabhu in a minute, but if you go, I don't know, to if you have darshan of the deities of Bhaktivinoda Thakur in Godrum, which are the deities of Gaur Gadadhar, we don't see Mahaprabhu with one hand up, one hand down also. So there are different deities of Mahaprabhu with different mudras, and neither of them cancel these two principles of what he's relishing as the primary purpose of his lila, was just explained, and the consequence of that. As you shared with me yesterday, I think this lovely video by Srila Sridhar Maharaj that I happened to watch some years ago, but it was very nice to see it again, the reason behind Mahaprabhu's dancing, because this hand movement is part of his dance as well. So he's dancing because he's celebrating that he has been successful in relishing Radha Bhav. No, so he celebrates. Like when you are happy and successful and celebrate, you start to dance. No? So, and the extension of that, the giving of the gift to everyone is an extension of his celebration of his inner experience. So in the terms of, in connection with Dameshwar Mahaprabhu, of course, that's a more localized case, if you will, because it's a form of Mahaprabhu for all of us, but especially for Vishnupriya Devi, right? It's one of the main deities, the first deities of Mahaprabhu, carved of Mahaprabhu. And there are different stories about it, about being carved, about being manifest, and so on and so forth. But the principle is the same, which is, of course, as we know, Mahaprabhu accepted sannyas in the earthly lila because Vishnupriya remains Nimai's wife in eternity in Golok Navadvip, we do not relate to Mahaprabhu as Mahaprabhu even, because the word Mahaprabhu means great master. So it still is kind of an Aishwaric name. As we were talking with Christian Chan in Switzerland, then the name we will use the most will be Nimai. Nimai. She's a very informal village-like name. It's a nickname, actually. It's not even his name, right? It's not Bishvambar Mishra. It's Nimai. Oh. So we'll call God by a nickname. Right? Because again, Mahaprabhu means one name of Krishna is Prabhu, the master, the Lord. Mahaprabhu means great master, great Lord. That's Aishwaric. Now, Chaitanya is his name of as a sannyas. It's a sannyasi. So now he's not a sannyasi. Nobody likes the name Chaitanya in one sense. In terms of the eternal associates. And there are many songs composed to that effect from a place of genuine bhava. So in Nitya Navadvip, Nimai remains the eternal husband of Vishnu Priya Devi. But in the earthly Leelas, we know Mahaprabhu Nimai becomes Mahaprabhu, Sri Krishna Chaitanya becomes a sannyasi and leaves Navadvip, and he never returns. And Vishnu Priya becomes a widow, if I'm not mistaken, by 16, she's 16 years old or something. So it's a very young widow and in separation from Nimai. So as we know, she starts to become emaciated by in love and separation and to chant the names of Nimai and count grain and rice grains, and that's what she eats. But at one point, yeah, Mahaprabhu becomes manifest in the deity form as Dameshwar to become present to Vishnu Priya. So it's a very personalized delivery, if you want to put it that way, in which Mahaprabhu comes to tend to the heart of his beloved consort in that particular way, which of course the two extended hands in this case, which I don't know if the camera is taken, like the two hands like Dameshwar. It's also a mudra of full giving, or like full giving of myself to the other person. No wonder that's mostly the, going back to what we were talking before, that's the mudra we find also in Gadadhar Pandit, most of the deities of Gadadhar Pandit, which is Radha giving her own heart to Krishna so Krishna's Mahaprabhu can be fully successful in relishing her bhava. So this mudra of two hands raised, and sometimes we find them in details of Nityananda Prabhu, which show how Nitai is fully giving Mahaprabhu to others. So whatever the case, whether it is Mahaprabhu, Dameshwar, Nityananda Prabhu, Gadadhar Pandit, the implication is a full delivery, a full indiscriminate giving. So that was the way in which Nimai wanted to tell Vishnu Priya, I'm here, fully here with you. Even in one sense, I'm not here at all and I'm not returning here in this lifetime. I'm fully here in this particular form. So yeah, that's something very, again, very specific in connection to Vishnu Priya. It's a deity that basically manifested, as we always say, the deity manifests as a result of the heart of the longing of the worshipper. So it's a corresponding form of Mahaprabhu to tend to the necessities of Vishnu Priya's heart. And by extension, of course, others. It's not limited to her, but it's primarily was primarily carved out of her heart, so to say. But yeah, besides Vishnu Priya, besides her specific case, the mudra is a mudra of full self-giving, full self-disclosure, full generosity, which doesn't cancel what Mahaprabhu is relishing. Because again, whatever Mahaprabhu is giving is what he has relished before. You cannot give what you don't have. So even if the hand is not raised, doesn't mean that he's not relishing what he's relishing. But at the same time, and this is one last point, and I don't want to become too technical, but remember, Vishnu Priya in this case is just considering an incarnation or on an expansion of Radha as Bhu Devi, as the deity related to Mother Earth, an expansion of the Shakti. Because this is interesting, remember, Mahaprabhu is Krishna, wanted to taste Radha Bhava, and Radha appears as Gadadhar, but Vishnu Priya is Mahaprabhu's wife. So my point is that that's why that's the main difference between the worship of Gaur Vishnu Priya and Gaur Gadadhar. That's a whole conversation. Bhaktivinoda Thakur established both, one in Jogapith, Gaur Vishnupriya, and his private bhajan chamber is Gaur Gadadhar, because those are different, two different modes of worship. So the raised hand of Mahaprabhu has to do with his relishing of Radha Bhav. But that's not so much related between his connection with Vishnupriya. That's a different relationship. And that's why probably we could say he's not appearing with the hand raised, because that's not such a prominent feature in the connection between Nimai and Vishnupriya, the relishing of Radha Bhav. That's more in connection to Gaur Gadadhar. So to Vishnupriya, he appears with both hands like that, giving himself as a husband, as Nimai's husband, all to Vishnupriya. That's a particular self-disclosure of Bhagavan to Vishnupriya, which is not the same of hand raised, relishing Radha Bhav, hand down, distributing that Radha Bhav to others. That's another feature of the Gaur avatar. Not just a feature, I would say the main thing. So as I hope you can see, there are different flavors and possibilities within Gaur Lila, different relationships between Mahaprabhu and his eternal associate. So that could be another way of explaining when there is no hand raised in Mahaprabhu, because the high relishing of Radha Bhava is not so much a feature between in his relationship with Vishnupriya. But the message of the moment was not for Mahaprabhu to give Vishnupriya Radha Bhava, but to tell her, "I'm here fully for you in our particular relationship." I hope that helps.
Yes, no, that helps a lot. Yes,
Okay.
Mahaprabhu.
And second question for tomorrow morning in Spanish. If
Okay.
all of you want to know which is his question, you have one day to learn Spanish. Okay. We have one more question. I'll skip one more breakout room since somehow the topic is connected. And we'll go to the last question by Nityananda, and then we'll go to a final breakout room to share all together one more time. Welcome, Nityananda. You can unmute yourself. I'm not sure if he's there. He was there before with the camera on, so since the camera is off, probably he left screen for a moment. Okay, let's do something then. Let's move to the breakout rooms for a few minutes. Mahaprabhu wants us to go to breakout rooms and discuss all these topics, whether it is Dameshwar, Nitya Gambhira, Nitya Puri, whatever it takes you. And we spend some minutes there, and we'll see if Nityananda is back after the breakout rooms for the final question. See you back there. Okay, welcome back. Hoping you had some nourishing Gaur Katha together. One last try with Nityananda, though I don't see the camera activated, but if you can hear me, Nitinandaji, I don't know if you are there.
So I would like Maharaj to ask your reflections on half of how we as devotees can deal with feelings of loneliness, which sometimes come, especially when we are in separation with our loved ones and dear ones, because sometimes life can, have some turns when this situation happens, and so how we navigate these moments when which are not so easy to navigate. So I'm just like very curious what would be your reflection.
Thank you. And thank you for bringing the question despite the time over there. Sorry for keeping you up so late, and many of you as well, and for keeping the Kiwis up so early, depending the case. So, navigating loneliness. Well, I'm sorry I don't have all the time I would love to have to answer such an important question, because we are kind of at the end. But a few words, of course, we can share. Well, I'm talking in general, because there's always, as I always like to think, hopefully without pre-assumption, without assuming, but generally there is, so in this type of questions at least, there is something personal happening for the questioner, and of course I'm not inviting here for any personal confession or testimonies, but many times there is always a question behind the question, right? Like a more localized situation behind the more generic thing. So I can say something in general, but I'm sure I will be missing many of the specificities of any given case. Well, first of all, recognizing there is such a thing called loneliness and not condemning ourselves for feeling it, just in case, I think it's an important first step to start with, because many times we have this great capacity to feel terrible about ourselves for feeling things, for feeling not the, for not being feeling the highest things and feeling things that are not supposedly the more transcend, the most transcendental, and then we start to just smash ourselves, so to say. So I think it's good to have a normalized acknowledgement of that, despite it maybe still may be a symptom that we are not fully enlightened, let's put it that way. That doesn't need to bring misery to our lives, right? It's not that every time I have a symptom that confirms I'm not enlightened, then I have to torture myself and I'm become even less enlightened by doing that. That's not the idea, no? Like I remember always the Buddha's first noble truth. He will say, there is suffering. No? That's it. Like acknowledgement, acknowledging that there is such a thing. Because if we do not acknowledge it, we will never even be able to treat it, to deal with it, because we will live in denial of that, or we will accept that but refuse to accept that and resist that and stigmatize that. Which again, I'm not saying this is your case, Nityananda, or anyone's, but it can happen. It can happen. So that's the spiraling down of misery, right? Like we are feeling loneliness, which in itself brings its own pain. And if on top of that we feel terribly bad about feeling lonely, then we are bringing another layer of misery that could be avoided. I'm not saying that loneliness altogether could be avoided for everyone in any situation, because again, we are not fully enlightened, so we can feel loneliness. And we, according to our realization, we may not be able to avoid it. Okay. But at least we can avoid other things that sometimes tend to gather around, whether it is loneliness or any other thing, in the forms of guilt and shame and feeling terrible about ourselves for feeling those things. So if I cannot work on my loneliness, let's put it that way, if I cannot, I mean, I can, but if I cannot stop feeling that, which again, there's place for that, at least I can also spend some time, what is avoidable, no? What can I work on? And so we don't make the situation even worse. So that will be the first part of the answer, which sometimes is the main part of the answer, depending the case. And then loneliness, of course, invites us for introspection, because technically speaking, we are never alone, right? So loneliness entails the feeling that I am alone. And again, I don't want to sound insensitive by saying, in principle, nobody is alone. So in principle, nobody should feel loneliness, because we are all accompanied, interconnected, sambandha, everything is interrelated, God is in your heart. Now, we can bring all the all the doctrine to bully other people, and again to bring this spiraling down into shame, which is not the idea. At the same time, it's good to know that. It's good to know that in the midst of my loneliness, actually I'm not alone. Actually, I'm not disconnected. Actually, I belong. Actually, I'm, even if it's reminding that in principle and still some theory, I think it's a healthy context to not lose sight of that bigger picture. To some degree, that may help. And to some degree may help, I don't know, as the particular example you mentioned, okay, you may be, I'm using you as an example, I'm not talking about you, but you may be, or someone may be living in a particular country, but the rest of their family may be in some other country for whatever reason or something like that, some separation, and you're missing them. Again, I wouldn't say that's terribly wrong and that's the worst thing that you could feel. It's a normal human feeling. I'm not saying at the same time that's the goal of life and stay there forever, because at the same time, again, it may be coming from a place of still some degree of attachment to a certain role and identity in principle, I don't want to sound too sannyasi saying all that. But also we don't want to become overtly enmeshed into that particular role, and that's my ultimate swarup, so to say. So finding a balance of what's the bigger picture, and at the same time acknowledging my humanity, my affection for certain particular people who are close to my life. And sometimes, on one side, of course, loneliness as missing them could be a confirmation of my affection for that people, which doesn't need to be something bad. Again, separation, all the idea of love and separation is basically, or grieving. You know, grief is a lot about pain for the things that that matter most to me. So it's an indirect affirmation, but something very positive. And then again, if I still, on one side, loneliness again is missing someone else, but also feeling lonely myself. That's probably the main subjective experience. I feel lonely. And I will say in that case, one needs to do something about it. And whatever that may be, no? I mean, to get in touch with people, to talk with friends, to have someone to talk to have someone to say, I'm lonely, and to call someone. And I know it's not the final solution, but sometimes we need to enact those connections, because sometimes we do not do that. And sometimes that goes back to my initial point. I feel ashamed of calling my friend and tell him that I feel lonely today. So because of shame of feeling lonely, I don't reach out. And because I don't reach out, the loneliness perpetrates even more. But if sometimes we reach out and someone is there that I really cares for me and lends an empathic ear, it makes me feel that I belong. It invokes connection, it invokes presence. I'm no longer alone. I mean, I'm never alone, but I no longer feel alone. So sometimes we need to take those steps. And sometimes, again, it may be hard because we need to get out of the shell of guilt or shame and dare to show up and to allow other person to see me as lonely, as fragile, as vulnerable, which in its own way is beautiful if it happens in an environment of trust and intimacy and friendship, to be seen in those moments and to receive care, attention, love, feedback. That's empowering, that's nourishing, that's fulfilling. But if we do not do that out of shame and guilt, the spiral goes down and down and down, and I feel more lonely and more ashamed and more miserable and more isolated. And again, I'm saying all this in the context of a situation that for the time being cannot change. Like the example I gave, okay, I'm missing my family, and because of that, I'm feeling lonely. And they will come in a few months, but until and unless they come, I'm feeling lonely. So you cannot force them to come on time. So what to do about it? And at some point, the family may be there, may not be there. And that's also the point. At the end of the day, is I cannot depend on my mom, wife, children being next to me not to feel lonely. Because what will happen when they will not be there? There will be a point where they will not be there, at least in a physical sense. Or we won't be there. Who knows who lives first? So my point is, how do I live a life where I'm resourceful enough that I can live by myself without feeling lonely? And therefore my connections with other people are not coming as from a place of, oh, I need you so I don't feel lonely, but I'm so fulfilled that I'm overflowing into you. I mean, that's ideal scenario. I'm not saying we are all there. But even the relationship should take that form gradually. Not so much, you have to be next to me so I don't feel miserably lonely, because you become like a lonely filler for my whole, so to say. And it becomes self-referential at every moment. So how do I develop a capacity to be with myself and not feel lonely, which will be the capacity for solitude, which is not the same as loneliness. And from that place, and it's a gradual cultivation that we learn to be with ourselves, because that's another conversation. Sometimes we have a pretty hard time being with ourselves. And we feel lonely because we don't have certain people. But if we learn to develop a connection with ourselves, and of course with God in our hearts and so on, then loneliness starts to dissolve. And that's an important lesson we all need to learn. So whenever we have people in front of us, we do not grasp onto them just to like survive loneliness, but we go from a place of more fullness, not so of absolute emptiness and desperation, but of fullness. And we celebrate together our fullness, and therefore the relationships become really nourishing rather than draining, right? So anyhow, I threw a few considerations all over the place. I don't know if any of them hit the target or help in any way. I trust some of that may help. And of course, just in case, going back to my main point, Nityananda, if that's something you happen to be experiencing, you are not alone, right? Which again, I think it's very important to remind ourselves and to have people in our life reminding us what you may be going through is not what you are going through. It's what many of us may be going through at times. And therefore, we are all in this together in one way or another. So to not isolate ourselves in the experience, I think, is the first most urgent step to take, and everything else follows from that. I hope that helps.
Thank you so much, Maharaj. Especially, I like your point about relating to others from the place of fullness. This is very, very insightful, and all other your thoughts were definitely nourishing.
Thank you.
And yeah, thank you so much for
Thank
the
you.
insights, Maharaj.
Thank you. But of course, again, relate to it from a place of fullness. Sometimes first we need to be filled to approach the other from a place of fullness. So we cannot just demand upon ourselves. I need to be full, so I relate to them from a place of fullness. I will be fooling myself if I do that. So that's why we need to have, hopefully, sangha, community of friends, brothers, sisters around us, so we can become nourished and filled, and then we can approach with that fullness in heart. And there are no limit to the fullness, as there is no limit to the emptiness. So let's choose the right option and let's go to fullness without limits. So, but thank you. Thank you for the important question that is relevant to so many of us. And let's conclude for a few more minutes, just a few minutes, to with the last breakout room to put our sharing to rest, but to share and turn together. So we share together, we don't feel disconnected from each other or lonely. We can open our hearts and share about this important topic for a few minutes and see you back for our final farewell of the day. Okay, welcome you all back again. Hoping you had a good, nourishing sharing, rumination from one heart to the other. And we are putting our sharing to rest today till the next Saturday. Same time, we are returning to our usual time, which is 2 p.m. EDT time, probably for the next year or so, since I'll be mostly here in the US. And I'll meet you next Saturday from Harvard. So your prayers, your blessings are welcome for this chapter of the adventure in which we'll be. I'm carrying all of you together there, and you're carrying me in your heart. So it's always a mutual caring and caring as well. So thank you so much to all of you for your presence, for your sharing, inquiries, sincerity, and love. Sriman Mahaprabhu ki jai, Shri Hari Nam Sankirtan ki jai, Samaveda Bhaktavrinda ki jai, Sadhu Sangha ki jai, Gaur Premanand Hari 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 Bol.